Hamish, this is Stan. Welcome to Civil Banter. This is episode number 8, The Dog Law Days of Summer. So we're two civil litigators at Nelligan Law helping people through injuries, insurance fights, and life's legal curveballs. Our first segment today is going to be the frequently asked and answered questions.
F-A-A-Q, two A's.
There's a pun in there. We'll explain it at some point in the future, but not today. And so in this segment, we'll be answering what you've been too afraid to ask your lawyer. So starting out, Stan, the frequently asked and answered questions today are: one, will the court punish the defendant?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes they will. And those are referred to as punitive damages. So in the case that somebody has done something egregiously wrong or extremely deliberately wrong, then the court can award punitive damages. I will say it's really not the norm to have a punitive damages award, and it has to be specifically proven. We tend not to see that a lot of the time. In our world, we deal with negligence, which is simple wrongdoing by inattention or by not applying yourself as properly as you should to a situation. But yeah, I mean, the short answer is a court can punish a defendant. The longer but still short answer is it doesn't happen that often, and it has to be pretty egregious.
Right. And we're usually dealing with damages being compensation. So they're compensating for a loss instead of punishing bad behavior in our world, generally speaking.
That's right. Yeah. The idea is to make you as whole as possible in light of what's happened to you. So the court's going to try and put you into the position that you would have been had this wrong not occurred to you and not happened to you. And so really punishing a wrongdoer or a defendant does not really factor into making you whole. It's really only when they've crossed the line in a really bad way that that kind of consideration comes into play.
Right. And so the next question that I'd like you to answer is one that I've never been asked, but I feel like it's a question in clients' minds, which is what you tell me, the client, the same thing that you go and say to the judge?
Great question. I actually have had this asked of me, and no, almost certainly not. So when we advise our clients, and I'm going to use that word deliberately here, it's we are giving them our advice on the issues that they face in their lawsuit. And we're saying, look, you know, this is what you need to do to prove your case. These are the hurdles or evidentiary burdens that you need to meet. And these are the challenges that you're going to face on either proving liability or proving damages, or here's another factor that may come into play, likability, those kinds of things. Is it a jury trial, et cetera? And a lot of the time we're delivering maybe not bad news, but news that makes a client think about the likelihood of success. And that's not to be, deliberately down pushing on expectations. It's to simply advise of the risks associated. And so we'll make our clients aware of those risks, but we're not going to broadcast those to the judge unless, you know, it's so obvious you want to address it.
Yeah. On. It's warts and all is what we tell the client. You know, we're saying, these are the good things about your case. These are the bad things about your case. These are the strengths. These are the weaknesses. Now, we're providing a kind of sanitized version of that in court. We're arguing something that's legally defensible as a position, like that we're comfortable arguing and advocating that position. But at the same time, it's a more sanitized, focusing a lot more on the strengths, you know, downplaying the weaknesses. So it's not, you know, it's a difference in purpose.
Well, I put it up to advice versus advocacy.
Right.
Right. So we advise clients and act on instructions. And then upon those instructions, we advocate on their behalf in whatever form it happens to be. And so in that case, we push it and we advance their arguments and we move forward with their case and we do it with great enthusiasm and, obviously hopes of success. But behind the scenes, we make sure that they're aware of the risks that they might not succeed. So to circle back to the question, we almost always say very different things to the clients versus to a trier of fact.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay, Stan, what do you have for me?
Well, I've got one here. What do I have to prove to win a lawsuit? Like, how do I prove things?
Okay, so this is something that's different from a lot of the pop culture depictions of, because it's typically criminal law in pop culture. And when,
it's a lot more interesting and exciting.
More interesting, more exciting. And the news that makes the headlines is typically criminal law. So criminal law, the Crown in Canada and Ontario, the prosecutor has to prove facts beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's right.
And so this is why, you know, you're following a murder case or a high profile case. And if there's a reasonable doubt that someone did what they were accused of.
Didn't do.
What you said. Didn't do what they're accused of.
Then you must acquit.
You must acquit. Yeah. So we're probably, you know, we're probably making a whole host of criminal lawyers' eyes roll. But
I think we're on point so far.
And that's. I think it's fair to say that's kind of often conceived of as being like 99%. Like you have to prove things at a very high standard with a high degree of certainty. Not absolute certainty, not scientific certainty, but beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. Not unreasonable doubt. Right. You can't go too far afield. It has to be, you know, conceivably possible.
Right. And then in civil litigation, which is our world, we only have to prove things on a balance of probabilities.
Is this where we get the scales of justice from?
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, I think it is.
Good insight. Yeah. So balance of probabilities is, again, just in a percent term, it's kind of, you can think of it as 51% or more likely than not. And how these two situations interact in cases that I've worked on is, on the one hand, if someone is criminally convicted of a certain act, like, for example, if there's a conviction based on a driving offense for speeding or reckless driving or driving while impaired, that's now been, there's a conviction and that's total.
Well, it's conclusive proof of negligence.
Exactly.
What it is.
It's conclusive proof. You can't have a civil lawsuit about damages and say, no, he wasn't speeding.
Right. Right. If there's a finding of speeding by a trial judge or provincial offenses court, I think that would be a justice of the peace, then that cannot be relitigated. And the component of that aspect of the lawsuit is proven. It's considered to be proven.
Absolutely. Now, on the flip side, if someone was charged but not convicted of speeding or an offense, or even in a sexual assault case or something like that, you can still have a civil lawsuit that follows that.
And this sounds an awful lot like a big trial in the United States from the early 90s. Right.
And it's obviously speaking about the O.J. Simpson trial, but it's open to the civil court and civil litigation on a balance of probabilities to still conclude that something did in fact happen or someone was in fact speeding. Or someone did in fact commit murder.
100%. And that's because the standards to put somebody away in prison, to take away their liberty, they should be higher and they are higher. And civilly, we're just talking about money at the end of the day, unfortunately, as much as it's maybe difficult to say that for people who've had bad things happen to them, it's just money at the end of the day. So mm-hmm. the standards are different and you can be acquitted in criminal case, but still be civilly liable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I have one last question for you, a quick one, I think. But do lawyers wear wigs here?
Okay. So at one point, from my very brief historical research, it sounded like, yes, there was a time when they did. The white, you know, the white curly wigs with kind of a slight ponytailish vibe, very aristocrat looking. At one point, lawyers in Canada did. And apparently this got dropped in around the 1800s. In the UK, they historically did, and they still to this day. So in England, a practicing barrister, because the which isn't a true distinction we have over there between lawyer and barrister, but in England, a barrister and a judge would both be wearing wigs. So maybe because of the heat, I'm not sure, but the heat in the summer, but it would be helpful in the winter, but...
It might be.
But no, we don't wear wigs over here when we're in court. I guess optionally we could. I don't know if there's a rule against
wearing That's a wigs. Good question. yeah, I don't know.
but what we do wear is we wear a particular type of court shirt with a interestingly pointed collar. This is only in court and it only in specific.
Yeah, you're really not supposed to wear it outside of the court.
Yeah. Tabs, which are, I mean, it's like in between a tie and a bolo tie, but white, I guess. It's.
You'll see that on staff at the House of Commons as well.
Yep. And we wear black or gray or striped pants or skirt. And then I always had it described as a waistcoat, but it's kind of more of a, I don't know.
I think waistcoat's appropriate.
It's called,
jacket.
I see it more as a jacket because to me, waistcoat means no sleeves, but.
Really?
Perhaps a tailor could correct me on that. Civil banter at nelliganlaw.ca.
Yeah, let us know.
And we wear robes, which I would just describe as straight out of Hogwarts. It's probably the most fun and interesting part. We do wear robes when we're in Superior Court of Justice.
And those are another ones. Great in the winter, not so hot. Very hot in the summer. So yeah extremely warm. And I like them. I think they're a good leveling of the playing field. You don't want to have, you know, a lawyer overdressed or underdressed and, mm-hmm. and have the jurors thinking about that. And it should really just be about the advocacy in front of them. So I think it's a good leveling of the playing field and important and, you know, really not that big of a burden on people to have to wear.
Yeah. And if you want to go sit down at the Starbucks on Elgin Street, I'm sure you'll see plenty of criminal defense lawyers sprinting down Elgin in various states of wearing what I just described.
Yeah.
Between the waistcoat, maybe no tabs, maybe robes or gowns in a bag. Those are the frequently asked and answered questions. We're on to the topic of the episode, which is, of course, dog law.
Dog ownership, dog liability, the dog law days of summer.
Yeah. And so, you know, dog bite claims are something, for whatever reason, before I came to Nelligan's, I just hadn't come across a dog bite claim. But the, you know, there's some uniqueness because of DOLA, the Dog Owners Liability Act. So, you know, tell me a bit about the act and what is covered in terms of civil liability in the event of an injury related to a dog.
Sure. Yeah. It's actually the Dog Owners Liability Act was the first thing that we worked on in law school.
Okay.
At least at Windsor when I was there. And I think it's because it's supposed to be easy to understand. And I think it can be. For those of you who don't know, the Dog Owners Liability Act, it's exactly what it sounds like. It establishes the rules around liability that arises from something your dog might do. And so what this law covers is civil liability for dog owners. And it also talks about some quasi-criminal Provincial Proceedings Act stuff that we won't get into. It bans certain breeds of dogs in Ontario, such as pit bulls, but we're going to focus on the civil liability aspect of it.
And so it kind of is treated a bit like I'm an individual and I have something that's property, which is sort of can be dangerous. And it's kind of treated like that.
Yeah. And so what it does is it defines who owns the dog, and it's not just legal ownership, but also harbors or possesses the dog, which we will get into when we talk about a couple of cases here. But what it really does is it just establishes that an owner or somebody in possession or harboring a dog is automatically liable for the damages that that dog causes. And that is with respect to a person. So if the dog bites or attacks somebody, that means that you're on the hook as the dog owner. It will also cause that owner to be liable for what their dog does to another domestic animal. So if your dog attacks somebody else's dog or someone else's cat and injures or unfortunately kills that animal, then the owner of the dog will be liable under this legislation pretty much automatically. There are provisions for contributory negligence on the part of the injured person. And, you know, we'll save that for a different day, but that is out there.
So let's back up a bit and let's distinguish a dog bite accident or a dog bite injury and how that type of claim proceeds from the other types of claims we work on, like someone gets in a car accident or someone trips and falls. What's the key distinction between how these operate?
Well, in this case, the legislation, the Dog Owners Liability Act, says that the dog owner is going to be found liable. And it's basically an automatic thing. If the dog is owned and it does something to cause an injury to somebody or another domestic animal, then they're on the hook for that. And you don't really have to get very far into proving what happened. You have to prove that it happened. Obviously, you have to establish that there was an attack or a bite. And then you'd have to link the injuries you sustained to that bite. But you don't need to prove negligence and you don't need to prove wrongdoing on the part of the dog owner. You don't have to say, well, you were a bad dog owner, or, you know, you sent your dog after me. That will obviously help your case. And
right,
a situation where somebody literally sicks their dog on you, maybe there is, to circle back to the top, punitive damages there. But in this case, you don't have to show or prove negligence.
Yeah. So it's as simple as that. There's no questioning of you didn't raise your dog properly. You didn't teach your dog properly. You didn't have your hand on the leash properly. That's not really going to come into this. There'll be background facts, but it's not something that's a burden that we'd have to prove to be able to essentially get compensation for dog bite injuries. And
that's
the
right.
Other thing, the contributory negligence part, essentially, you know, I suppose that would come up in an injured person did something that sort of invited it.
I suppose so, yeah. If an injured person had provoked the dog,
yeah,
or had attacked it initially, started it
to
use like a child example, yeah, you started it, then maybe in that sort of situation. I will say there's an important carve out here for guard dogs. So if you own a dog and somebody breaks into your house, then they can't sue you under the Dog Owners Liability Act because your dog bit them in them breaking into your home and committing a crime. There is a carve out there that allows you to keep a dog and not worry about liability in the case that somebody's burglarizing your home.
So I'm not a current dog owner, but historically, my family had a miniature poodle. Okay. Her name was Poppy. Poppy Doodle.
Poppy Doodle the Poodle.
Name.
Yeah. That's got a nice sort of rolls off the tongue.
Now, does the Dog Owners Liability Act say anything as to whether a miniature poodle could constitute a guard dog?
I think any dog could be a guard dog if it's brave enough.
Okay, let's get into some of the cases in brief.
Sounds good. We'll sort of do these chronologically. I picked a couple of cases that I think are worth chatting about for a few reasons. The first one I'm going to start with is Wilkes and Arbor. It's a 2016 case. And this one is, I think, noteworthy because it discusses who is considered to be an owner under the legislation. And we'll just run through some quick facts here. But Donna Marie Wilkes, the plaintiff, was the girlfriend of the defendant, Kevin Arbor. And this incident involved Mr. Arbor's dog, Zeus, good name for a dog, a 9-year-old Great Dane, that had a lot of medical issues, unfortunately. It had a seizure disorder. It was on a special diet. It required medication. So Wilkes and Arbor, they're in this romantic relationship. And Miss Wilkes frequently stayed at her boyfriend's home overnight. You know, on the night of December 27th, Mr. Arbor, he'd worked a long 20-hour shift. That's incredible. And he'd asked Miss Wilkes to feed Zeus at specifically 6 p.m. He had a very regimented diet. And, you know, then he comes home, he goes to sleep. The next morning, Miss Wilkes asked if she could take Zeus for a walk. He agrees. I guess lost in there was that she hadn't fed the dog again in the morning. And
he's a hungry boy.
He's a hungry boy with medical issues and seizure problems. So, you know, unfortunately, Zeus goes out on this walk with Miss Wilkes and he has a seizure, collapses and falls into a ditch, which is, you know, quite worrying. Zeus,
poor guy.
Yeah, a Great Dane. I think I mentioned that, but if I didn't, Great Dane, large dog, and slips out of his collar and goes into this ditch. Miss Wilkes attempts to retrieve him from the ditch. But unfortunately, you know, he's quite frazzled. He's in a ditch. He's got these problems. Bites off her thumb, the top half of her thumb.
Hell.
Yeah. So Miss Wilkes brings a lawsuit against her boyfriend. I don't know if they stayed together after this incident or not. You know, realistically, I think maybe there's insurance money involved and there were no hard feelings and mm-hmm. they're just looking for some compensation. But the counsel or the lawyers for Mr. Arbor, they bring a motion to dismiss her claim on the basis that she was an owner of the dog. Right.
Right.
So she lives with them. She's looking after the dog. And the judge on this motion to dismiss the action had to make a decision about whether or not Miss Wilkes was considered to be an owner. In this case, on the facts, the judge said, no, she's not considered to be an owner. She was under very specific instructions about how to care for the dog. She didn't exercise any real control. She was just following instructions and certainly didn't do this on a daily basis, definitely didn't live there on a daily basis, not considered to be an owner. So in that case, you know, that shows that if you're at least a part-time partner of somebody and their dog injures you, and you might have a claim.
Yeah, interesting. And it's like owner, you know, when someone thinks owner, they're going to think, you know, I own my house, I own my car, I'm on title, I have a permit.
Piece of paper.
Right? Yeah.
Piece of paper.
It's not quite that in the Dog Owners Liability Act. It's broader, but we've just found one of the important limits where ownership is broader, but it doesn't cover this situation. So
that's right.
What about some other situations?
Well, we're going to keep that in mind for the last case that we're going to discuss. There's going to be one. I said I'd go chronologically. So the second case I wanted to chat about is a 2024 case. It's from the Ontario Court of Appeal. Kind of an interesting idea here. It's called Walpole and Crystal, if anybody cares. But the lawsuit arose from a really unfortunate accident where some visitors to a home brought their young daughter, and the young child was bitten by the dog at this premises, bitten in the face. The people living there were tenants. So they didn't own the property that they were living at. They were tenants, and I gather uninsured tenants. So we've talked about insurance a lot on this podcast. You can get insurance for tenants insurance, which will cover you. It typically comes with a general liability provision, which would have protected them in this instance.
Right. It's not just insuring their couch.
Right.
It's also insuring them if they...
their negligent actions.
Yeah.
Which includes ownership of dogs. So these tenants, they're not insured. And I gather the plaintiffs in this case, the daughter, the young girl who was injured, they're looking for pockets for compensation on this. And they had the creative idea, I guess, their counsel, of trying to find if the landlord could be liable as an owner, basically. So the landlords are named as defendants to the action. They're not happy about it. Their lawyers advise them and bring an action or a motion to dismiss the claim against them. So they're bringing a motion for summary judgment to say, we shouldn't be liable on this case. Please let us out. And at the trial level, the motions judge decided with the landlords, dismissed the case against them. This case made it to the Court of Appeal to determine the extent of the landlord's liability. So one of the issues here is that under the Dog Owners Liability Act, if a bite occurs at the premises of the owner, then the act prevails. The Dog Owners Liability Act, or DOLA, is the act that's going to govern how we decide liability.
Okay.
Not the Occupier's Liability Act. And in this case, the motions judge improperly found that this meant the owners were exempt under the Occupier's Liability Act. And the Court of Appeal said, no, the trial judge was wrong. The Dog Owners Liability Act supersedes the Occupier's Liability Act only with respect to the owner of the dog, not necessarily the owner of the property.
Right.
So the owner of the dog liable under Dog Owners Liability Act, owner of the property potentially liable under the Occupier's Liability Act.
Right. And the difference there is Occupier's Liability Act is not as simple as strict liability. If damage happens, you're responsible. There's more to it than that. It's a bigger analysis.
We'll reasonable system it. Of maintenance and inspection. Yeah. It's not an insurance clause necessarily. You still have to show that there was some kind of negligent action on the part of the occupier or owner of the property.
Right.
So in this case, they kind of split hairs over it because ultimately the Court of Appeal dismissed the action as against the landlords. They said, look, they're absentee landlords. They're not there every day checking on the property. And in any event, there's a prohibition from preventing tenants from owning domestic animals like dogs. So you can't ban a tenant from owning a dog. And right. the landlord had no notice that the dog was dangerous. They're not going to be liable. So they, good try. It, I think, opens the door in certain situations mm-hmm. to say some landlords who are maybe more hands-on mm-hmm. or who have notice of previous, you know,
dangerous
dogs. Maybe the neighbors are upset about it, or maybe they live across the street and they can see that there's a vicious dog there. So
they live in a duplex and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not a door closed, but in this case it was. So mm-hmm. that's case number two. And the last one, kind of circling back about, you know, who is considered to be an owner of a dog.
Or are they harboring a dog?
Or are they harboring a dog? This is a 2025 decision, quite recent. Nigro and Luciano. And in this case, the plaintiff was actually an employee, not a direct employee of the defendant, but the defendant had hired a dog walking company. Mm-hmm. That dog walking company hired the plaintiff. Plaintiff's looking after the defendant's dog. Dog's got a great name, Forrest Gump, which I think the judge went out of their way to mention as Forrest Gump and not just Forrest, but great name for the dog.
And also, if you're a dog lover, it's hard not to just find this kind of cute in
yeah.
terms of the setup, in terms of, well.
Yeah, you want to run through some of the facts on there?
Yeah. March 24th, 2022. While attempting to put booties on Forrest Gump, because he's a boxer dog and he's recovering from a paw infection.
Poor Forrest. He can't run anymore.
But while the booties are going onto his little paws, Forrest Gump attacked and seriously injured her.
Yikes. So she brings a claim against the owners of the dog, and they bring a defense that actually Miss Nigro's a owner, or she's harboring the dog. And in this case, the court said, yeah, she is. She's a paid employee. She's looking after the dog. It's part of her ordinary course of business. She had been there a lot. She was familiar with the dog. She knew what she was doing. And she knew that obviously he had some needs with respect to the booties and the foot, and he was dealing with some problems post-surgery. So in this case, they said possession can include physical possession and control of the dog, and that
dominion
over the dog, and she had that.
Okay.
So case dismissed. Unfortunately, what were on the facts, and I won't get into those, like pretty vicious injuries, it sounds like, and no compensation available to her under those circumstances.
And then the takeaway between this case and the one we talked about initially, I mean, paid, expected to have control over the dog.
Actually did, in fact, exercise a degree of control in much more so than in the first case with Miss Wilkes, who I think was kind of roughing it and trying her best to maybe be a good partner and not nearly as well suited.
Okay, well, putting a pin on dog law, we've had hundreds of emails asking for an update on Stan's experience at Escapade 2025.
Oh yeah. So previous episodes, we talked about this, you know, much talk in the office last year that I was maybe not the first guy that would have jumped to mind as an attendee of this music festival. And last year you would have been right. I would have been a little reluctant. There was a pretty good photo of me dressed rather conservatively in a raincoat, hat, and just standing at the back, soaking it all up, wondering, where am I? But this year I leaned into it. I got a much more EDM you know, suited outfit. I looked the part, I felt the part, and had a great time. It was an awesome event. I would recommend it to pretty much anybody. It was very respectful. Everybody had a great time. Hard not to have a good time.
Good location.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was skeptical. I thought, you know, last year, Lansdowne Park, this year, the RA Center. It was actually easier to get to. There's two light rail stations that are quite walkable to the RA Center. There's a large bus station there at Billings Bridge, and bigger venue, more spacious, less crowding.
Yeah.
Good times, hot, good weather. No complaints.
Yeah. It was awesome weather. And you know, at some point, we're just going to have to do an episode on liability issues that could arise at music festivals.
Yes. And somebody at our firm has one of these, which we'll tease. We'll just sort of leave that out there. Yeah.
Okay. And with that, we'll say our goodbyes. So you can find our team at nelliganlaw.ca. You can find me on LinkedIn at linkedin.com/IN/HMillsMcEwen.
You can find me on LinkedIn too. I figured it out. I've been there. I've been a little more active. I'm at linkedin.com/IN/StanfordCummings.
And you can send us any emails, topic suggestions. If you want to be a guest, potentially, you can shoot us an email at civilbanter@nelliganlaw.ca.
Yeah, if you want to send us your dog photos and they're sufficiently cute, maybe we'll put them in the middle here on the big screen. So that we'll just sort of float that out there for anybody who's interested.
Okay, and with that, please like, comment, subscribe, share to any friends or family members that might be interested in this. And that is a wrap.
Thanks a lot.